was no freeze framing beyond the house. I was never to go out any of the windows or doors. Outside was a country I wasn't allowed to visit until I was older. Both magical words that I heard capitalized, and the color of warm butterscotch when she said them. To discourage it, she kept the shades tightly drawn, shutting out all the interesting things to see. But I'd peek when she wasn't watching, and outside was irresistible. There were children, and puddles to splash around in, and sunshine, and fog, and flowers, and bikes, and things happening, and everything was always changing, like you were living in a TV show, and you got to discover the plot as you went along, even make it up and shape it yourself. I wasn't always great with her rules. She caught me in the yard more than a few times. One day, after she found me sitting on the front stoop, watching girls jumping rope in the yard next door, she tied me to the fridge, then went and bought a thick chain and screwed a heavy bolt into the sofa. She padlocked the chain around my waist. An hour later, I smashed the lumpy green couch to smithereens, dragging it behind me, trying to freeze frame through the doorway to the kitchen. She stood at the kitchen counter, making dinner, and I giggled and giggled, because I thought it was so funny to see the couch all crooked and skewed with the stuffing poking out. But she got angry, and said things I never wanted to hear her say again. So, for a while that felt like years to me, but was probably weeks, I stayed wherever she put me, until she told me I could move. It was inevitable outside would get me again, sneaking a peek behind the curtains, spying an ice cream vendor pushing his cart with dozens of children crowded around, licking their cones and spooning up their gooey sundaes, and allowed to be outside. And I knocked them over like little bowling pins, snatched up a whole tub of chocolate fudge caramel for myself, and was back inside the house before Mom even knew I was gone. All the vendor saw was kids falling all over the sidewalk, and maybe noticed a tub of ice cream missing. But I'd already figured out that when grown-ups couldn't explain something, they pretended it hadn't happened. I almost got away with it. I would have gotten away with it. I even had a plan for how to get rid of the empty tub. She brought my lunch into the living room. I shoved the tub of ice cream behind a chair, but she stayed and talked to me while I ate my beans, and the ice cream melted and puddled out, and she said those angry things again, and I cried so hard I thought my tummy would split. I crossed my heart, hoped I'd die, swore I would never disobey her rules again. And most especially that I would never, never go outside. She cried then, too. A few days later, she came home from the grocery store with hardly any food, but she had a bunch of tools and bars and sheets of metal. She told me we didn't have any more money, and she'd sold everything we could sell, so she had to go back to work. She was getting a dog to watch over me while she was out, and she was going to build a very special cage for it. She'd even learned to use a blowtorch and hammer to do it. I thought she was terribly clever and exciting. I knew it was going to be a very special big dog because the cage was ginormous. I knew why she had to build it inside. It was 3 times as wide as any of our doors. Shortly before it was done, I played inside the cage, imagining all the fun I was going to have with my new very best friend. With a best friend, it would be a lot easier to resist the lure of outside. I wasn't as strong then as I am now. My strength increased as I matured, along with my other senses. But I knew the dog we were getting was going to be very, very strong, because the bars on the cage were as big around as my mother's arm, and inside she bolted a thick collar and a heavy chain to the floor. She said the dog might have to be restrained sometimes when we had company. We never had company. I began to think I was the only one excited about the new addition to our family. While she worked on the cage, I'd dream up names for our dog and try them out on her, and her eyes would get strange and her lips would pull down. I've always slept hard. One night, my mother gave me a bath, dried and brushed my hair, and we played games on the rickety kitchen table until I nearly fell asleep on my stool. Then she carried me to her bed, where I lay my head on her pillowcase, the one with the little ducks, and I put my hands on her face and stared at her with sleepy eyes because I loved watching her while I fell asleep. And she held me so close and so tight, snuggled up in her good mam smell, that I knew I was the most important thing to her in the whole world, and I slipped off to happy dreams. The next morning, I woke up with a collar around my neck, chained on a small mattress, inside the dog's cage. 5. The days are bright and filled with pain. Jada. She stood by the edge of the mattress in the study on the silent, otherwise empty first floor of Baron's Books and Baubles, frowning down at the body draped in nearly transparent pieces of silvery cloth. Not that Riordan knew she was frowning, or even that she was in the room. Although his body shivered with agony, the rise and fall of his chest was nominal. She'd counted his breaths, twice a minute. His pulse was non-existent. He'd either gone into a deep meditation, or someone, no doubt Baron's, had put him into a magical healing sleep. Unwrapping a protein bar, she knelt by the mattress, lifted the edge of one of the pieces of fabric, and inhaled sharply. Raw, blistered flesh oozed pinkish liquid. She carefully released the edge and lifted another. He'd burned himself to the bone in places, to keep her safe. While she'd tried to rescue someone she'd known full well on some level, wasn't there. "The wound I refused to dress," she whispered, for a moment 14 again, chained in a dungeon with Riordan trying to get her to face the atrocities of her life, stare them down cold, acknowledge and make some kind, any kind of peace with them. His brand of tough love. The only thing that had had the slightest chance of penetrating her formidable armor. She told herself it wasn't concern but manipulation. Her thoughts and feelings about the man had always been at odds. She'd idolized him, craved his attention and respect, never trusted him. Yet what he'd done tonight, she could see nothing the mighty Riordan might have gained from it. She'd made her own kind of peace by freeze-framing into the future, faster than the wind, faster than any pain could follow. Seeking adventure, sensation, stimulation. Because as long as she was feeling something new, she didn't feel anything old. Past is past, she'd crowed to anyone who'd listened. She knew Riordan's words by heart. She knew everything he'd said by heart. Few adults had given her useful words. Tucked into a mega-brain behind a gamine grin and insouciant swagger, they'd always been treasured. "The wound you refuse to dress is one that will never heal. You gush lifeblood and never even know why. It will make you weak at a critical moment when you need to be strong." Tonight her unhealed wounds had cost her, and him. She'd watched him die once, gutted by the Crimson Hag. Somehow, miraculously, he'd returned from the dead, whole and good as new. She wasn't worried that he might die from these burns. Regardless, looking at him in this condition made her feel sick. She closed her eyes, reliving the abbey under attack, the bloodbath of a battle, so many dead, cut down so young, the hellish fire, the moment she'd felt her mind snap. Shazam! Riordan, stumbling from the inferno, carrying her and her stuffed animal, both unharmed. Which brought her to thoughts of the completed tattoo at the base of her spine, the cell phone in her pocket, and the certainty Riordan could find her no matter where she went. Of course, now that she had what she'd so desperately wanted, she couldn't justify pursuing a personal agenda. Forgotten in her hand, The protein bar had melted, and chocolate ran warm and gooey through her fingers. She devoured it in two bites, barely chewing, licked her hand, and pocketed the wrapper. Her hands curled into fists.
Riordan, we've got problems. Max gone. She tried to save us from the sweeper by using the Shisa Do. When she took a spell from it, the book possessed her. I can't find Barons. I don't know if Mac is still in there somewhere. I do know the book will destroy everything it comes in contact with.
She paused, then said flatly,
Logic dictates I kill her at the earliest opportunity.
Which technically had passed. She'd taken Mac's spear before she'd undone her restraints, erring on the side of caution. She should have attacked the moment the book revealed itself with its nightshade toxic gaze. She was faster, and the book had been having obvious acclimation problems, struggling to get off the table, swaying slightly as it found footing. She could have stabbed it with the spear, cleaved it in half with her sword, ensuring the body that held the Shisa Do would rot and die. Mac's body. Eventually. Slowly and horrifically. For a woman who lived by the motto, Carpe momentum, etc. sequentur, she never wanted to seize a moment less. She knew why, and told the unconscious man heatedly, Because friends don't give up on friends. They never give up. The body on the mattress shivered, but said nothing. Lost in the silvers versus lost in the book. Jada didn't perceive the odds of rescue as substantially disparate. The fallout, however, could be catastrophically different. One girl, never to be seen again, versus the Earth's total domination and destruction, assuming the black holes didn't destroy it first.
Lore told me you didn't know where I'd gone, she told the silent room. It wasn't your fault. It wasn't Max either. People need to stop thinking they're responsible for my actions. It wasn't like I needed to be rescued. I've never needed to be rescued.
She'd always found a way to save herself. Still, she knew intimately the despair of day after day passing, followed by nights cold, hungry, alone, of belief dying bit by bit. Mac had sacrificed herself to ensure Jada's survival. If Mac hadn't opened the Shisa Do and used a spell to save them, the sweeper would have sent horribly fixed versions of Mac and Jada out into the world, which might have been every bit as deadly as the book being unleashed on it. And who could say the sweeper's work on Mac's brain wouldn't have freed the Shisa Do anyway? There'd been no easy, good choices tonight. Only the lesser of evils. Two women, destroyed. Or one. Over her dead body was Mac waiting for a rescue that never came. As she stood and moved toward the door, Riordan muttered something too garbled for even her acute hearing to decipher. She glanced back.
You shouldn't be trying to talk. Rest, heal, get back on your feet.
He muttered again, jerking with such violence that several pieces of spelled cloth protecting his skin fell away. When she moved to the mattress and knelt to replace them, he blew the cloth from his face and went into instant convulsions from the effort. She didn't tell him to stop trying to speak. Riordan made his own decisions. Whatever he wanted to say, he badly wanted her to hear. When he was still again, she bent near his mouth. His once beautiful face was a charred, monstrous mask. Eyelids blistered. Lips burned to a raw gash. She'd done this to him. Her meltdown. Her heart the sweeper had deemed flawed. She'd always excelled at the pretending game, but she'd taken it too far this time. She'd lost sight of what was imaginary and what wasn't. And it had cost them all. Though she hated caring about, yet had never been able to stop caring about. He spoke carefully. Then passed out so hard he no longer shivered. It had taken all his strength to murmur a single sentence. Jada gently replaced the spelled cloth, eyes shining, torn between hushed awe and a fierce desire to snicker. He'd said,
Holy psychotic PCs, Robin. We've a murderous MacBook on the loose.
Batman,
she said, hoping he was in a place of no pain. This time around, I'm wearing the cape. She took the stairs three at a time to Mac's room on the fourth floor. It wasn't there. A room still occupied the location. It just wasn't the same one she'd been in earlier. The cozy, messy bedroom had been supplanted in her absence by a parlor with a red crushed velvet sofa, a faded Persian rug, crystal lamps, and a cheery fire burning in an enameled hearth. She walked back out into the stairwell and glanced up, eyes narrowed. When she left earlier to follow Mac, the stairwell hadn't continued past the fourth floor. There'd been only a ceiling with elaborate crown molding where now a dizzying staircase ascended. From years Silverside, Jada was accustomed to shifting spatial dimensions. Baron's books and baubles housed at least one powerful distorting silver, if not more, a mystery to be explored when time permitted. She found the Nine Secrets intriguing to an obsessive-compulsive degree. She located the bedroom on the sixth floor, on the left side of the corridor, not the right, shrugged out of her coat, stripped off her shirt, and swapped it for one of Mac's. Her clothing was stained with dried blood, entrails, and dusted with the pungent yellow residue of the zombie-eating wraith straitjacket she'd briefly worn. The combined stench was overwhelming her sense of smell, diluting it. After wiping her face with a damp towel, she scrubbed down her pants and boots as well. She grabbed Mac's black leather biker jacket and began transferring her many weapons, protein bars, and last remaining energy pod. While strapping on the sword and tucking the spear into a thigh holster, she spotted the cuff she'd given Mac on the table by the bed. She had no idea why Mac had taken it off, but she wasn't about to leave it lying around. She'd risked a great deal to take it. Crossing the room in a few long-legged strides, she shoved the cuff onto her wrist and pushed it up under the sleeve of her jacket. A charred stuffed animal, wedged between pillows on the bed, stuffing guts spilling from its slashed belly, watched her every move with round, shiny, reproachful black eyes. "I see you, Shazam." She shook herself briskly. Emotion was deadly. Plans and objectives clarifying. She tucked the stuffing back in, tugged the edges closed, and gently placed the teddy bear on a high shelf. Then she turned, dashed down the stairs, and burst out the back door into the gloomy Dublin dawn. She used her left hand, her sword hand, to trace the same spell she'd etched earlier to pass through the whirling tornado surrounding Baron's books and baubles. Black veins flared beneath her skin, licked up into her wrist, and her hand went ice cold. Many years ago, she'd stabbed a hunter with the Sword of Light, and something had seemed to seep through her weapon into her fingers. She'd learned at Silverside that her left hand cast better, stronger spells. It often itched and tingled, and sometimes at night, she'd wake up to find her hand cold and black. Shazam had professed a special fondness for being scratched behind his ears with her left hand, claiming it felt different. But when pressed for more information, the grumpy, cranky beast had merely flashed a Cheshire smile and refused further discourse. Shazam. Her heart hurt. Grief was a silenced wail that had no beginning or end, just a long, agonizing middle. Inhaling deeply, she focused on her city. She'd not seen a single person since leaving the warehouse, with the exception of Riordan, and suspected Barons was out searching for Mac, perhaps for her as well. The streets were empty, silent, glistening grey beneath a bank of dense thunderclouds. Were it a normal morning, if there was such a thing anymore, there'd have been both Fae and humans milling in the street. But any human who'd seen the Fae gathering en masse last night had either joined up and been killed, or gone to ground, fearing a death march similar to the one on Halloween when the walls between worlds had been destroyed. As she passed the church, where she'd nearly frozen to death, she scanned the black hole, suspended over the rubble, assessing size and circumference. It was larger by nearly a third, exuding a gentle pool of distortion. Mac had told her she could hear music coming from the black holes, but even with her extraordinary hearing, Jada couldn't detect the faintest vibration. She considered her current problems. Black holes devouring the world. The song of making lost. Nearly half her she-seers injured or dead. Another attack on the Abbey imminent until Cruz was freed or destroyed. The unseelie king and former queen absent. Mac possessed by the she-sadu. Banner day in Dublin. No time to print a daily. It occurred to her that if they could find a way to control Mac, the she-sadu, it might not be entirely a bad thing that she'd opened the book. If they didn't hurry up and find a way to patch the black holes on their world, or at least find a way to stop them from growing, the human race had no future. And allegedly, the she-sadu, scribed by the unseelie king, contained information about the legendary song of making. She'd pondered that allegation at length, not certain she believed it was possible because, according to all the myths she'd uncovered about the history of the Fae royals, including the many oral stories she'd collected Silverside, the king had never succeeded in recreating it. So how could anything about it possibly be in his book? Maybe the book contained clues? Bits and pieces the king had collected, hinting at the true nature of the song that, with Dancer's help, might be analysed and improved upon? Speaking of Dancer, she had to somehow get word to him that Mac had gone postal. She wondered if he still checked their hidden cubby at the O'Connell Street post office and made a mental note to drop him a message there, assuming she didn't run into him before then. He had the uncanny knack of showing up whenever she thought really hard about him. She eased up into the slipstream and vanished. In that higher dimension, the world slid by without friction. Buildings, people, their many messy emotions, disappeared beyond a beautiful starry tunnel. If only she could eat enough to maintain the metabolism to fuel it, she'd live in the slipstream and never come down. A superhero protecting her world unseen, untouched. She was nearly to Chester's when she crashed into a brick wall she'd not sensed, which meant one of the nine, and dropped back down. Scent came before sight. Jericho Barons. She ricocheted off his chest and went flying. With those lightning-fast reflexes that could pluck her out of freeze frame, he grabbed her arm and stopped her from careening violently down the street.
"Danny,"
he said. She tipped her head back and stared up into eyes black as midnight, a dark, savage face. Every hair on her body stood up on end, as if charged by a sudden surge of electricity. He threw off the same kind of primal energy as Riordan. She'd once crushed on Jericho Barons violently, before she'd realized he and Mac belonged together like earth and sky, night and day, fire and ice. She'd found tatters of legends about the Nine on some of the worlds she'd travelled Silverside, but never managed to find an origin myth. Only songs and tales of Nine merciless warriors who battled for gain, and despite dying, came back again and again. Unkillable, unstoppable, unbreakable. She hungered to be those many Uns herself. No matter the price. She snatched her hand away and smoothed her hair. "It's Jada."
"Have you seen Mac?"
he said. That was Barons. No small talk. She appreciated it and answered in kind. "She's been possessed by the she-sadu." Barons went so still she lost him in the early morning gloom. Just when she decided he'd left his disembodied voice, murmured,
"So that's why I can no longer feel her."
Then he was there again, morphing out of the brick wall that had been behind him. He could be a perfect chameleon when he chose.
"Are you certain?"
he said, so softly that she shivered, because she knew what soft meant from this hard, implacable man. It meant every ounce of his energy had just been diverted and channeled into a motherlode of a nuclear missile that was locked, loaded, and targeted on whatever had just offended him, and that he would expend no more energy than was strictly necessary to speak. Yes. His eyes darkened. Eerie shadows swirled in his irises, and a muscle worked in his jaw.
How certain?
Unequivocally.
What happened?
He said, a bare whisper. She tightened her ponytail, pulling it up higher. Her hair was curling again, or trying to. She hated it curly. It made her feel like Danny, out of control. Those at the Abbey didn't know the Shi Sadhu was once again roaming Dublin, and she had little time to fortify what was left of the fortress against the next attack, whether instigated by those trying to free Cruz or Mac herself. We have to get to the Abbey, Barons. We can talk on the way. He pulled out his cell phone, summed up a contact, and held the phone to his ear.
Do you feel the Shi Sadhu?
Jada heard a woman's frantic voice carrying clearly from his phone. She knew that voice. She heard it in nightmares, crying, begging, and finally screaming. She shivered, reached for another protein bar and wolfed it down. Barons, I've been trying to call you. I felt it about an hour ago, here, in Dublin. What's going on? You said it was locked up. How did it get out?
Where is it right now?
It's headed north, into the country. Then I lost it. Where are you? Where's Mac? I'm coming with you.
No, you're not. Find your parents. Stay with them until you hear from me.
But Mom and Dad don't know I'm alive. Alina stammered.
Fix that. And if you feel the Shi Sadhu approaching, take Jack and Rainey to Chester's and call me. If you can't get to the club, go to ground wherever you can.
What's going on? Alina demanded. I have a right.
Do what I said.
Barons hung up. Jada listened to the exchange with narrowed eyes. Realizing the woman Mac had said was walking around Dublin, looking and acting like her sister, somehow was on Barons's autodial. He seemed to believe it really was Alina. And, like Mac, the woman could sense the Shi Sadhu. But he didn't trust her entirely. Either that, or he didn't want one more liability to worry about.
Mac's headed for the Abbey,
Baron said. Jada filed thoughts of Alina away for later perusal. They were entangled with far too many emotions to be entertained at the moment. They went into the same box that held so many other things that she would get to. One day. By the time they got to Chester's and climbed into a big black armored military Humvee, she was operating with her usual machine-like efficiency, despite her many recent shocks and unhealed wounds. Past was past. Tidying up one's internal landscape was a luxury of the safe. Safe was something she'd never been. 6. Don't you know there's a fire in the hole? Mac. I force myself to stop screaming. The silence is absolute. I'm in a vacuum. No, that's not quite it. I'm drifting in space, blind, with no radio. Though my initial impression was of being stuffed inside a tiny box, and I know somewhere there are walls, I feel as if I'm floating without friction in a vast darkness. I'm aware of absolutely nothing but my own awareness of absolutely nothing. It borders on madness. Hell isn't other people. As Jean-Paul Sartre claimed, it's being trapped somewhere dark and silent with only your own thoughts forever. Terror wells inside. Whatever I now am. A disembodied consciousness? Do I still exist? Am I in a box inside my body or something worse? Am I dead? Is this being dead? Would I know? Fear threatens to obliterate me. Here, in hell, I want to be obliterated. I want the horror of the hellish awareness of only my own awareness to stop. I'm screwed. Barons may have punched into my head once to save me from the Shisadu, but back then I still controlled my body, and the book was locked away unopened. There's no way he's getting in here now, past the psychopath that imprisons me. I felt the power of the Shisadu. It was incomprehensible. Ugly, sick, twisted, hungry, and enormous as the unseelie king. It scraped me out of every nook and cranny of my body and stole it from me, and there was nothing I could do to stop it. In those brief moments of contact, I'd felt I, too, was a psychopath. Its touch had been so palpably evil, so saturating, that I'd been contaminated by its mere presence. It was bigger than me, more focused, driven by such an enormity of rage and malevolence that it, too, was enormous. I'd felt a mere mouse in its house. I remember the night the corporeal book almost made Barons pick it up. It was the only time I ever saw Jericho Barons back down. He'd raced through rainy Dublin streets away from the enemy. My sensory deprivation is absolute. It's as if the world doesn't even exist. For all I know, it doesn't. For all I know, the Shisadu has already corrupted. Using my body. Terror is a voracious thing, devouring the darkness around me. In moments it will devour me too. Whatever I am, I make my essence pause. If I were physical, I'd be a woman going still, eradicating emotion, focusing pure intellect on a problem. Even stripped of my body, I exist. That's enough. That's a starting point. I'm beginning to think that all the bad things that happened to me in the past year were simply the universe's crash course and waking me the fuck up so I could face this moment. Talk about condensed training. What haven't I already survived? This is just one more problem. Each one has always seemed bigger and more insurmountable than the last. That's nothing new. I will not cede the crumbs of my existence to mindless panic. Here, where there is nothing, I have something, and it's enough. Choice. I will choose anything over fear. Rage is fuel. Rage is gasoline. And Riordan wasn't completely right, because rage, wielded as a weapon, with focus, purpose, and skill, is also massively useful energy. Anger can refine, distill, clarify. Besides, there's nothing left to burn in here but myself. And if I incinerate my body in the process, good. 7. Welcome to the Slaughterhouse. I encounter a She-Seer in the underground city. We nearly crash into each other as we round a corner from opposite directions. I carry neither light nor torch. Shadows soothe my newborn eyes.
Mac!
The woman gasps. I access my meticulous files, attach neural impulses to visual stimuli. Her name is Marjorie. She's power-hungry and fancies herself clever. I drop the feet of the body I'm dragging behind me, coughing lightly to conceal the thud. She sweeps the beam of her flashlight over me. I blink and hide myself before the blinding glare hits my eyes to reveal serene green. I blink several more times. The light is brutal.
Get that bloody light off me,
I growl. I see bright spots on the dark walls, on her shirt, even after she turns it away.
What are you doing down here?
She says.
I was checking on Cruz, you.
I thought to do the same, she replies stiffly.
What with the fire and the attack, I feared he might have escaped.
And what were you going to do if he had? Raise a hue and cry? Scream?
Would you scream, Marjorie?
I purr. Her eyes narrow.
Mac, are you all right?
Never been better, I tell her, stepping closer, but it's not true. Something happened to me while I was destroying the slab in the cavern that once housed Cruz and me, smashing and stomping it so it could never be used again, that cold, hated stone. My body began to tremble. Walking had become a wobbly affair, and I'd had to sit for a time.
"Well then," Marjorie says, "let's go check on him together, shall—"
I punch my fist through shirt, flesh, and bone, and rip out her heart. I clench it in my fist and crush. Blood drips. Muscle explodes. Bits plop to the floor. Interesting. That's what gives them life. How fragile. Inconsequential. Marjorie's body teeters and slumps to the floor. Life to death in an instant. Not with a bang. Not even a whimper. It wasn't nearly as satisfying as I'd thought it would be. Disappointed, I grab Cruz's ankle, bump over the body, and continue down the corridor. I go up and up, winding my way through the many levels beneath the abbey, dragging my prisoner, who grows heavier with each step. I wonder if I should have eaten Marjorie's heart. Perhaps I weaken because my body requires food. I never paid attention to how often Michaela ate, or what. I consider when she last fed her body. It was quite some time ago. I decide to eat the next human I see. As I drag Cruz up the final flight of steps, my breathing grows labored. I pause at the top to catch my breath. For so long, I desired corporeal form. It was my sole focus. But like killing, my new body disappoints. Eons ago, before the bastard king trapped me beneath the abbey, I traveled galaxies the same way my prior incarnation traveled this world, luring host after host into picking me up, possessing them. I'd not found a single animate form I was able to possess that hadn't rapidly decomposed, until Michaela. But while she doesn't come apart at a level of cellular cohesion, her body has its share of weaknesses. I must find a way to temporarily strengthen the bird in my hand, besides eating the flesh of my children until I become fully, untouchably immortal. Beyond the half-crumbled wall that once concealed the stairwell, I hear the crush of stone beneath shoes. Someone is near. Abandoning Cruz's body, I skirt debris and hoist myself up and into the demolished room beyond, and smile. There's a pretty delicate thing searching the ice-covered rubble for supplies. Perhaps pretty delicate things, like strong, arrogant things, are more satisfying to kill. Marjorie was stout, dour, and dull, and died so quickly. "Full of fun and games and slowly," I murmur. "Then I'll eat. Or perhaps I'll eat while she's still alive. Perhaps living flesh better nourishes. Michaela never ate a human, bound by scruple, chained by morals, but it's conceivable that human flesh, like Unseelie, may confer some power. It's a theory worth testing. Michaela knows this woman well."
"Joe,"
I say, hurrying to join her.
"Can I help?"
8. One world. It's a battleground. Jada. She sat in the passenger seat of the Hummer, across the wide console from Barron's, ripping open a bag of stale chips she'd pilfered from a box of supplies in the back.
"Talk,"
Barron's barked as he started the Hummer.
"What happened to Mac? Were you there when it did?"
Jada recounted the tale, from the moment she'd seen Mac out the window of the bedroom, hurrying down the alley, following what had looked like an ambulatory trash heap, calling Barron's name, her decision to follow, her subsequent assault by the ZEWs, and waking in the warehouse, to the final moments of Mac's decision to take a spell from the Shisadu to save them. She was about to tell him what happened once Mac had risen from the table when Barron suddenly growled,
"Mac!"
"Where?" Jada straightened instantly. "Stop the Hummer?"
"Not here. The Abbey. I just felt her. She's furious."
"Sounds like the book to me."
Its malevolence in the warehouse had been staggering. So palpable, it seemed to suck the very oxygen from the air.
"It's her. I haven't been able to sense her at all for hours, and suddenly she's... Bloody hell. I lost her again.
Is it a tattoo? Is that how you know Mac's location?
You're wondering if Riordan can track you.
Yes.
Did he finish the tattoo?
Yes.
Yes.
Jada felt a muscle begin to twitch beneath her eye, pressed a chip-salted finger to it, and willed it to go still. Riordan hadn't told her that along with being able to track her if she phoned him, which put the ball in her court, he now had his very own Marauder's map of her, that he could unfold and observe any time he chose, which put the ball in his court. There was no place she could hide, not with Dancer, not snooping at Chester's, perhaps not even in Ferry. Is it something you have to think about, or do you just know where she is all the time?
It requires a little thought.
You said she was furious. Does the tattoo allow you to feel what she's feeling?
Certain emotion. At times.
How accurate, and how far is the reach? She said coolly.
Depends.
On what? She said frostily.
Get over it. No magic is without price. You asked for it. Riordan has no single-edged swords, nor do you.
Maybe not, but at least I don't go around. Baron's cut her off.
We have bigger problems than your irritation over not having absolute freedom and control. We all want that. None of us have it. One thing signifies. If you'd known, would you still have asked for the tattoo?
Jada closed her mouth. Even knowing, yes, she would have taken his tattoo. She quickly polished off the last of the chips and ripped open a candy bar, wondering where the Nine stored their enviable supply of food. And why? It wasn't as if she'd ever seen one of them eat. Baron said,
After Mac used the spell, what happened?
The Sweeper and the Wraiths vanished. The book pretended to be Mac at first, and said that it had sifted them backward. Barons looked at her sharply.
In time?
That's what it sounded like, Jada said grimly.
Fuck,
he said softly.
If it can manipulate time.
We're in a world of shit, she finished for him. Barons was silent a moment, and then said,
Resume. I want to know every detail, no matter how seemingly insignificant.
Closing her eyes, Jada recreated the scene in her head and painted the picture for him with attention to details that would have impressed even Riordan. Half an hour from the Abbey, Jada stretched and the cuff on her wrist pinched her arm. Thinking she'd slid it up too far, she unzipped the sleeve of her jacket and shoved it back to reposition the wide armband. The ruby gemstones on the gold and silver cuff glowed as if lit by tiny crimson flames. She turned it this way and that, examining it. Bugger, she muttered.
What?
Barons demanded. The cuff she'd so easily removed many times in the past had somehow become a seamless band of metal, with no way to take it off short of hacking off her own hand. When she'd stretched, it had caught on her arm, trapping a tiny piece of her skin. My cuff? It's closed. It never was before.
Where did you get it?
I took it off Cruz when I first arrived at the... Oh, shit!
What the fuck?
Baron snarled. He hit the brakes so hard it gave her whiplash. An enormous red object had just materialized out of thin air. It crammed the entire front seat from window to window, lap to ceiling, obliterating her view of the windshield. It was wedged in so tightly, the two of them were packed beneath it like sardines in a can. She tried to kick up into the slipstream, but nothing happened. She was too tightly compressed. Shifting her focus swiftly, she sped up only her fists and began pounding the intrusion.
Jada, it's not attacking us. Look at it.
Baron snarled. She drew her fists in close to her body and shot him a look. Are you kidding me? I can't see anything but it. She barely had enough room to keep her head jammed back against the seat, the scant few inches between it and her face. Barron's had adopted a similar posture, head back against the seat, studying it through narrowed eyes.
Mac may have sent it. I've seen those runes before.
What runes? There aren't any runes on it. It's a bloody red blob.
The whole thing is made of runes fused together, and it's not entirely a blob. There's a foot jammed up against my window.
What kind of foot?
What do you mean, what kind of foot? How the bloody hell many kinds of feet are there?
Among the Unseelie alone, thousands. Hooves, tentacles, claws, pincers. Then there's the Seelie cast, humans, animals. Be precise.
A human foot. I see toes.
Painted nails?
No.
Harry?
No hair. Big feet. Male.
Jada frowned. She'd never seen anything like it. Not here, not Silverside. She lightly prodded it. It instantly stung her fingers and tried to latch on. Much as the stinging sentences from the Bura Bura books in the Unseelie King's library had once done. Barons, we've got to get this thing out of here! When he kicked open the door, the blob expanded instantly, exploding out, dangling from the Hummer, and Jada finally had enough room to shove it off her lap and vault from the vehicle. Barons maneuvered himself from beneath it, dragged the blob to the ground by a foot, and they stood, staring down at it. What the hell is it? She demanded. Barons paced a tight circle around it, examining it from every angle.
The question is, who?
Well, whoever it is was either enormous to begin with, or the runes caused it to grow and expand once employed. She still couldn't see any runes. Without another word, Barons grabbed it by a foot, dragged it around to the back of the Hummer, hefted it, and quickly thrust it in. When the rear doors wouldn't close, he stripped off his belt, looped it through the handles, and tied them together. What are you doing? What if it keeps growing? The blob did. She'd loved that movie. Had gorged on jelly beans and Snickers, watching it with Dancer, a long time ago. In another lifetime. Snickers. How could you not love a candy bar that was named after a good turtle? It could absorb us both. Then who will save Mac?
Shut up.
Barron said flatly.
And get in.
Arlington Abbey was the first taste of life Jada had experienced beyond a cage. It had been as magical and mysterious to the 8-year-old girl, who'd known neither friends nor freedom, as Hogwarts to Harry. Exhilarated to be free at last, she'd zoomed about like a drunken Energizer bunny, unable to stop, unable to eat enough, talk enough, see enough, live enough. No collars, no chains, no bars. Just the great big wide open. Toilets, not bedpans that piled up outside a cage. Choosing what to eat, not living in dread that nothing would be brought. Having a drink of water whenever she wanted it. Simple things. Priceless things. Initially, she'd considered Rowena's stifling control inconsequential, given how her life had been. Until she began to see how much damage resulted from the headmistress's machinations, that the she-seers were becoming less, not more, weak, not strong, because of her dominance, subtle manipulation, and sinister experiments. There were the cages you could see, and those that weren't so easy to spot, before you were lured into them with sweet promises and lies, until you were stuck like a fly on sticky tape, with only your shattered innocence for company. Then Mac had come along and seen it too. The certain destruction of their order if drastic measures weren't taken. Upon escaping the Silvers, Jada had made drastic measures one of her top priorities. She'd begun shaping the women into teams of skilled fighters, with the clear goal of becoming strong, focused, empowered warriors on behalf of Dublin and the world. She'd worked with each she-seer in turn, identifying their strengths, and working to enhance them. She fortified the Abbey with magic she'd learned at Silverside. She found herself somewhere she fit, and could always return to, which she'd never had before. A place where she was valued and respected. 5.5 years of wandering had changed her perspective on many things. The Abbey was a ruin. We'll rebuild. She stared as they entered the long drive, past the fey corpses to the smoking shell of the once mighty fortress. Near the front entrance of the abbey, women tended the injured and wept over the slain. Her gaze lingered on the piles of the dead, and her hands fisted. She'd just been getting to know many of them, had quietly reveled in each step they were taking toward becoming empowered warriors. And just like that, their lives were over. Gone. Ash and dust, as if they'd never been. Their only future now to become a name chiseled on stone. A catch-all for confidences, tears, and belated regrets. She forcibly dragged her gaze away and turned it to the black hole on the grounds. The large, inky sphere suspended against a slate sky, and was relieved to note the abbey wall had collapsed and no longer posed a threat. Baron stopped the Hummer inside the gate, got out, untied the doors, and replaced his belt, then dragged the blob by its feet out onto the grounds of the estate, away from the vehicle. He shouted in an unintelligible language to a shadowy figure patrolling the wall, flanked by three of the enormous black-skinned beasts that had fought beside the she-seers last night. She'd seen him many times at Chester's. When she'd been younger, he and several of Riordan's men had managed to hem her in, despite her freeze-framing abilities, while Riordan interrogated Mac. His name suited him. Despite standing a good 4 to 5 inches taller than Riordan, with a heavier build, he was easy to overlook. One moment, etched in stark relief against the moss-covered wall enclosing the abbey grounds, the next, gone, until he re-emerged from a smudge of shadow.
"Fade,"
Baron said, and moved quickly away with him. As the two men spoke softly, Jada pricked up her ears, but they were speaking a language she didn't know. After several moments, Fade issued a series of commands to the black-skinned beasts, and they fell on the blob, snarling and slurping noisily. It took her a few seconds to realize they were eating the bloody skin off the thing in an effort to free what was inside. What were these dark, lethal beasts of Max that she'd found in the Silvers that could imbibe such dangerous magic? Why were they obeying Fade? What language did they heed? More importantly, how might she gain control of them? Last night, when Mac had alerted her to their presence in battle, she'd watched them carefully, assessing friend or foe. Like the 9 the beasts Mac had brought could kill the Fae, with no apparent weapon. That made them every bit as valuable as the sword and spear. Speaking of the spear, Jada shouted across the lawn to Enyo Luna, the tough young, half-French, half-Lebanese woman she'd found wandering Dublin, leading a cocky band of hardened, militaristic she-seers. When the walls had fallen, Enyo and her women undertook the long, dangerous journey to Ireland, adding to their numbers along the way, seeking their birthright and a place to call home. The natural-born warrior had fought her way into the world, inside a military tank, the only safe haven her mother had been able to find, in a town in Syria under heavy fire. Enyo had drawn her first breath in the midst of war, and maintained that was where she would also draw her last. Draped in rounds of ammo, face bruised and blood-spattered, dark eyes gleaming, she loped like a graceful dark panther across the battlefield toward them. In war, she was 100% focused and committed, the best of the best. But in everything else, she was unpredictable. War kept Enyo's restlessness and wildness under control, yet Jada was uncertain what she would be like in a time of peace. It took one adrenaline junkie to know another. When Jada tossed her the spear, Barons watched it fly end over end through the air, measured Jada a long moment, and nodded. "So, it's ours again," Enyo said, catching and sheathing it in her waistband in a fluid movement. "Does that mean we've lost Mac?"
"No,"
Baron said, dangerously soft.
"I've lost many things. Mac will never be one of them."
"In a manner of speaking, for now," Jada told Enyo. "Has there been any sign of Cruz? Do we know if the prison holds?" We've no cause to believe he's escaped, but haven't looked. I'll send Shauna below to check.
If you see any Fae alive... Jada didn't finish the sentence. Enyo was already moving away, dark gaze shifting across the battlefield, watching for movement, spear at the ready. Jada moved closer to the blob, ceding the beasts a respectful distance, and stared down at the thing that was being released from its crimson shroud. Now that part of the fleshy cocoon had been torn away, she could make out the individual runes from which it had been knitted, and realized she had seen them before. Mac once used a few to prevent the Grey Woman from sifting that night, nearly 6 years ago, when she'd saved Danny from a gruesome death at the Grey Woman's hands. The night Jada's world had bottomed out, and she'd been exposed as Alina's killer.
It's Fae. Has to be a prince. Looks like something hacked off its wings. Brutally.
Fade said.
Pure rage.
Barons murmured. You think it was Mac?
Jada clenched her fists, forced them to unclench, worrying that the prince lying face down on the ground was Christian MacElter.
He didn't deserve this. He'd had enough misery already.
First being turned unseely, then getting captured by the Crimson Hag and killed over and over again, and finally losing his uncle to the hag's cruel javelin. Once he'd spared her from having to make a hellish decision by sacrificing himself. It was a debt she didn't feel she'd fully repaid.
I've seen her use these runes before. They're from the Shisudu. She's eliminating the princes. If you hadn't taken the spear, this one would be dead.
Jada glanced quickly at Fade. Where's Christian? Have you seen him lately? He shook his head.
Not for the past hour or so.
Baron spoke to Fade again, in the same unintelligible language. Jada said tightly, If you don't trust me enough to speak English around me, I don't trust you enough to work with you. Are we a country, or are we islands? I make one hell of an island. Your call.
I told him to turn the thing over.
And you couldn't say that in English?
I just did.
Fade issued another series of guttural commands. The beasts rolled the unseelie over on his back and resumed tearing off the runes. When the face was cleared, Jada released a soft sigh of relief. She'd last seen this prince in a prison of ice below the abbey. It was Cruz, not Christian. Then she stiffened. We've got to lock him up again.
I'm not so sure of that.
Barons disagreed.
But he's the Shisudu too, she said.
I'm not so sure of that either. I think he absorbed the knowledge of the book, whereas Mac may have been absorbed by it. Cruz read it in the first language. The spells passed up his arms. From what you described, that's not at all what happened to Mac.
Jada saw nothing to be gained by assuring him Mac had definitely been absorbed. She hadn't been in the cavern the night the corporeal Shisudu was interred, and didn't know the details. But Cruz wasn't throwing off anything like what had been palpably emanating from Mac, the dark whirlwind energy of a pure psychopath.
We have to find Christian. If he wasn't first, he'll be next.
Baron sliced his head in curt negation.
Without the spear or sword, the book can't kill Christian. And these beasts can release him. We must determine the significance of Cruz appearing in the Hummer.
On the ground, the unseelie prince stirred, groaning. Barons prodded him with the toe of his boot.
Wake the fuck up, Tink, and tell us what happened.
Cruz opened his eyes, blinked up at Barons, and vanished. Jada shot him an incredulous look.
You just set him free? I thought you left a few runes on him.
Why would I do that?
They prevent the Fae from sifting.
And you're just now telling me this?
He said, with equal incredulity.
I thought you knew everything. You always know everything. You recognized them.
That doesn't mean I know every blasted detail of what they bloody do.
He snapped.
Well, I suggest you grab a few before the beasts finish them off.
If we don't get the chance to use them on him, they might be of use holding back.
While Barons dispatched Faye to fetch a container, Jada closed her eyes and pinned Cruz's sudden appearance in the Humvee on her mental bulletin board. Around that inexplicable event, she tacked